Good afternoon, everyone. I have known Father Daniel Lord for nearly 30 years, but I've always admired him and wondered at his tremendous talent. A devout priest of the Jesuit order and a man who could have been a national figure as a producer of theatrical enterprises on Broadway or in Hollywood. A little over 5 months ago, word came from a St. Louis hospital that Father Lord had cancer of the lung with no hope for his recovery. It's difficult to know just how to begin this interview, but if Father Lord's understanding, if his attitude and philosophy toward his situation will help someone else who is similarly afflicted, then this half hour should be worthwhile. Father Lord, I'm sitting here watching the clock, and we have 28 minutes, and I'll just hold up my hand as the clock goes around.
I'm glad you're watching the clock, because I've stopped watching the clock for quite a while now. You see, you begin to think in terms of unlimited time and unlimited eternity.
When did you first get this... You had cancer of the lung, and that, well, you just wasn't any way to fix it.
I got that news in January. I have had, for the last few years, two very wonderful doctors, and they were treating me for what I thought was something else. Then they walked into the room one day after a series of examinations, and I could see from the look in their eye they wanted to break something to me, you know, a little funereal. So I told them to go right ahead, that it wasn't going to be any surprise to me, and they told me. The joke of it is that I've had cancer for about 6 years. I had cancer of the bladder, and I didn't know I had it. They were able to take care of that and keep me in perfect working order for 6 years, so when this next one came along, the one that the people are interested in, it was really a secondary cancer and not the primary. Well, I have had it for 6 years.
Of course, you have another lung.
Yes, but this isn't both of them.
This isn't both?
Oh, yes. I've got both, Scott.
This question of cancer, Father Lord, and that's why I've asked you to visit on In Our Opinion today. It's been forcibly brought to the attention of people, I think, in the last few years. We've had all sorts of warnings, campaigns, and I think some people have developed a fear complex. What is your attitude toward this fear complex that some people have as they read and listen to the symptoms?
I've congratulated the newspapers on having done a very wonderful job. It seems to me that this national campaign to make people aware of the fact that there is a thing called cancer, that it's very far from being the most terrible of evils, has done a great deal of good. Time was when a man got the sentence of cancer and he ran like mad to hide himself away. That was the end. If a woman suspected that she had cancer, the last thing in the world she wanted to do was to be told positively she had it. She'd avoid the doctor. She wouldn't have an examination. She'd see a small lump of some sort and say, "I guess it's cancer." Instead of having taken care of, she ran. Now she's afraid. And I think it's a very wholesome fear. Remember the old expression, the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom? Well, maybe the fear of cancer is one of the beginnings of health. And that an enormous campaign means that, well, I used to have a funny experience when I was at St. John's Hospital in St. Louis, where I was being treated. Across the street from me was the big St. Louis Cancer Research Institute. And I used to look across at them and say, "Get busy, boys, get going for me." And I think that's the way a lot of people feel about it now. We're so glad that we're afraid, and they're so glad so many people are working.
Well, you know, you look awfully good this morning sitting opposite me here.
Thank you.
You look rosy and full of pep and life, and it's hard to realize, Father Lord, that you have this virulent disease that's frightening and taking away so many people. There are many types of cancer. You've had it. I suppose you've become quite an expert on cancer.
Like anything else, I got curious about it. I don't believe in amateur doctors. And I think there are too many people who are pretending to be doctors and practicing medicine without a license. So I never pretend to talk professionally on a subject like this, but as a matter of fact, as soon as I found I had it, I began to read up on it and to talk to the doctors, chiefly to talk to the doctors. My first question when I was told I had it was naturally, how long? And that led to the first discovery, which I think was very reassuring. They said, "We haven't the slightest idea." And I was puzzled by that. I think doctors are infallible, you know. I have a great belief in them. They're wonderful people. And I said, you mean you can't tell me? And they said, no. Might be 6 months. Might be 6 years. You might slip in the bathtub and be killed that way. So I said, well, what's the difference between the various types? And they said, it all depends upon your reaction to the speed of what they call the wild cell. In a young person, that wild cell may move very fast. In an old person like yourself, it may move quite slowly. So they say we have had cases of people who have come in here. 6 months later, they come back, and there's absolutely no sign of what was a very clear cancer in the first instance. Sometimes the healthy cells build up a wall around it, buttress it in. The healthy cells get to work, and they seem to isolate it. It will stay that way for years. So anyone who predicts on a case like this, I think, is making a very rash statement. And the doctors won't make it. So anyone with cancer can just say to himself, I know I'm going to die someday. So do we all. I have the warning that this is a particular type of disease. That's a blessing. It's nice to know what you've got the matter with you. And as far as time is concerned, no one knows.
Perhaps your philosophy of life, Father, has... perhaps I can say has increased your span of life, the attitude you take toward it. Other people similarly afflicted, having given the same information you've been given, might greatly accelerate the disease by their worries.
Is
that possible?
I don't think there's any doubt about it. The most interesting thing the doctors tell me nowadays is the growth of interest in this whole matter of psychosomatic medicine, the relation of your mind to your body and your body to your mind. And when I asked them what I was supposed to do, once I knew that I had the trouble, the cancer, they said, well, keep cheerful. Keep just as much in your normal life as you can. And that's the biggest help we can get. That's more important than medicines or anything else. When people collapse under it, when they take the attitude of, oh, well, this is the end, and throw up the sponge and quit, it's very likely to be the end. And the sponge is up, and they do quit. But if you keep at your work and you keep cheerful, yes, I think there's a lot to it. We had an old story among the Jesuits, which I think some of you may have heard, about how under certain circumstances, St. Ignatius was playing billiards. He's the founder of the Jesuits, with some of his associates. And one of them said, if you knew in 15 minutes' time that you were going to die, what would you do? Well, the men around the billiard table, one of them would get down on his knees and pray, and another one would go to confession, and another one would balance his accounts, and Ignatius said, I'd finish the billiard game. And I think that's the answer. Finish your billiard game, if that's what you're playing.
I suppose you've had many letters from all over the country since this announcement came out.
Oh, people have been wonderfully good. This is one of the times when you really get to know, George, the goodness of people. I have had literally thousands of people who have taken the trouble to write to me. Some of them were people that I'd known when I was 6 years old. Grandmothers have written to me and said, I used to play with you when you were 5 years old, and I was four, back on Vincennes Avenue in Chicago. I've gotten letters from people I haven't heard of for 50 years, 60 years. And then, of course, these wonderful letters from friends, and oddly enough, this tremendous number of letters from people I've never heard of. All of them kind. I haven't had one letter which hasn't been kind. Some of them surprised me a little bit. A number of very good and conscientious people have written to convert me to their way of thinking. One lady wrote to me and said, you have a very kind face. I could tell that by looking at you in the newspapers, but one look and I could see you had never been baptized. Well, I got quite a kick out of that. I thought I'd better go back and look up my baptismal record. And then, of course, I've had a great many letters from people who had cures. You'd be amazed at how many cures have been developed. I understand, by the way, that the International Business Machine people maintain that if they could get hold of all the cures for cancer and put them through one of their screening processes, they could probably hit the right one. That is someplace there in the research. But I had one man who wrote to me and said that if for the rest of my life I would drink nothing but carrot juice, I'd live. I preferred to die. Another man, of course, this grape cure. I don't know whether you've heard of that. You'd eat nothing but grapes for the rest of your life. And then, of course, a number of people have written in their experiences. But the letters that have interested me most, I think, have been the letters from cancer patients. Young men with cancers. Husbands whose wives have discovered they had cancer. People who have been pretty low over the whole idea. Well, I've had hundreds of those. It's been quite a task, but so far I have been able to answer every letter that came to me. And I've made them as personal as I could make them. Because I thought anyone who was nice enough to write to me under those circumstances deserved a personal letter. They've been wonderful people.
Yeah, but with all these letters to answer and all these things, you have still kept pretty busy. As this broadcast is being recorded, it's going to be run a few days after this great preview of this University of Detroit film, this Light Up the Land. Now, you did a lot of work after you got out of the hospital on that. You went to...
Oh, yes. When the doctors told me what was the trouble, I said, well, does that mean I retire or do I keep on? And my doctors, who have known me for years, said, the only thing in the world for you is just to keep on your normal way of living. So, just as a matter of interest, George, in the last few days, I have come from Milwaukee, where I gave the commencement address to 10,000 friends and 900 graduates of Marquette University. And just before that, I was up in Toronto, where we were getting ready for our big Marion Year show, which will be put on for 11 days in the Coliseum of Toronto, beginning October the 8th. That's a little plug, by the way. Detroit isn't very far from Toronto. I go back to St. Louis, and I start a six-day summer school in which I shall teach 3 hours a day. And that will mean being on my feet and doing a considerable amount of talking for that time. So, lots going on.
You're still interested in the typewriter and in music, but principally in people.
Well, the most interesting thing in the world is people, as you know. No one knows it better than you, and no one has lived it more than you. To me, everything in the world is directed to people. If I have written, I have never written anything in my life merely for the joy of writing. I've always felt that was a temptation which I sincerely resisted. There was only a certain amount of time to write, and I have never written without someone definitely across the table, almost whose face I could visualize. To me, everything that I have ever done has always been with people in mind. I don't think I could change that.
There's another type of cancer in the world, and I didn't even expect, as we sat here, Father Lord, we'd even get to that point. But when you mentioned it, I think there's a type of cancer we've got to cure, and that's the cancer of communism.
Quite. But the answer to me on that always remains the same. The answer to communism is Christian democracy, and until we are willing to live like Christians and act like Democrats, we are not going to lick communism. Every time a neighborhood takes an attitude of hatred or bigotry toward a racial group or a minority group, we have no inferiors. A minority group, we are just handing the communists a ready-made victory on the battlefield. Every time that we exploit a laboring man, every time we tax business out of existence, we are making another easy conquest for the communists. When we'll start to live like Christians and start to live like Democrats, we don't need to worry about the communists.
Well, I was thinking of comparing it with cancer in this respect. You remove a little portion of cancer and we still leave the seat of it.
That's right.
Well, in Korea, we removed a little portion of it. In Indochina, if it's necessary to go in there with our men, which I hope it will never be, we'll only remove a little seed of that. I don't think that's getting at the root of cancer.
No, but I think when my doctors gave me the recipe for still staying alive, they gave the recipe to your problem there. They said, develop your healthy cells. I was went up to Toronto recently, and the question was, would I take the cobalt treatment? They said, no. It's wonderful, but don't take it. Develop your healthy cells. The healthy cells will take care of the sick cells and the well cells. Now, what we have tended to think of is, let's fight communism instead of, let's develop our own healthy national life. If we had any place in the world, a spot where we could say, there is a practicing Christian democracy, we could point it out, it would be such a shining example to the rest of the world that everybody would be itching to get it. You wouldn't have to fight them.
Well, then, out of this discussion of your own personal ailment this Sunday afternoon, we have developed this question of healthy cells. I think that's one of the most interesting things I've ever heard.
Healthy families, healthy communities, healthy business, healthy labor unions. Every time you get one of those things that's sick, you've got a disease center, a focus of infection. And that's the reason why each one of us is such a very important person. We talk about democracy. There isn't any such thing. There's just the men who make it up. We talk about government, that abstract thing that nobody has ever seen and never will see, thank God. Government is people. We're back on it again, George. It's people. And as long as the people are healthy, the cells are healthy, and the body is healthy.
Perhaps then we may be able sometime, Father Lord, to start a campaign of healthy cells.
Absolutely. Let's get healthy.
I'd like to take this last 3 or 4 minutes to repeat the philosophy. Hope, knowing that there are men and women, young and old, listening today who have fears, who may have cancer, who do not have the attitude toward this coming to the end of the road that you have. And we all come to the end of the road.
Oh,
we
yes.
Get on the elevator going down.
The beginning of the next one.
That's right.
Well, it's a good deal like this. First of all, when I got the word that I had cancer and it was an incurable cancer, I must admit that I had a feeling of relief. There were a great many diseases I don't think I would have had the patience to bear. Cancer was not one of them. As Time magazine always says when it talks about the death of somebody that's interested in, death, as it must come to all, came last night too, and then mentions his name. As it must come to all. Now that's the beginning. If for me the end of the road was the end of the road, I probably should dread it. I don't believe it is. I believe it's the beginning of the more abundant life of which Christ spoke when he said, I came that you might have life and have it more abundantly. So actually, we have been living, each one of us, in preparation for the moment when the bright angel of death would come and say, you're going to walk through the gates of the grave, which look black and dark, but on the other side is life and the more abundant life. That's the first. Then it seemed to me that I was given an opportunity to clean up a lot of work that was unfinished, to get a lot of things straightened out, to see friends that I had been neglecting. I've even started, however far I'll get with it, to write my own story, just because I thought it was of interest to me and a few of my friends. Then I found out all of a sudden that life looked very precious. The world looked more beautiful. Time became so valuable that I tried to squeeze every second I could out of every hour. I suddenly realized how many things there were to be done that I hadn't done and I still wanted to do, and places to see and friends to talk with. But most of all, I suddenly knew the goodness, I think, of God. Because every death is a beginning. And every death is the homecoming of the prodigal, whose father is waiting for him on the top of that distant hill with his arms extended in expectation of his arrival. And the road is beautiful and life is wonderful and it's very dear to be here. But for a person who has faith and a determination to fit himself into God's plan, the end of the road is the really exciting time. And that's the more abundant life.
Well, thank you, and
God bless you, Father Lord. Come in here.
Thank you, George, for the chance. When you come to that word love, of course, you come to one of the most difficult words in the world to define. It's one of those words that includes everything. Alice in Wonderland called it a portmanteau word. The kind of word into which you can stick anything. So you love French fried onions. You love your mother. You just love a new hat. And you love your husband. It's one of those words that you just use for such a variety of things that when you come to it, you say to yourself, well, what does it mean? I remember talking to a very young catechetical class years ago. And they're the youngsters out of whose mouth, of course, comes wisdom. We were on faith, hope, and charity. And as I was a very young teacher, I tried to cover the three subjects in one evening. That was all, just faith, hope, and charity. Well, they got to know what faith meant. They got to know what hope meant. Finally, I said, what is love? Now, come on, children, think hard. What is love? And a little girl in the very front row rose, and she put her hands together, and she said, love is the sweetest thing. Gee, I thought that was perfect. I... St. Thomas himself couldn't have done better, huh? Now, when we talk tonight about love, let's understand we're talking about love. There's a lot of words, or at least there are two notable words, that we use as an equivalent for love, and they're no equivalent at all. The gospel of a Sunday ago said, according to St. Paul, and there remain these three, faith, hope, and charity, and the greatest of these is charity. St. Paul wouldn't like that. He said it in a language which became Latin, and the translator took the word caritas, which is a rather lovely word, and turned the thing over into the English word charity, which is as ugly a word as anybody has ever had to listen to. I don't know why, but nobody likes charity, and everybody loves love. If you pretend for a moment that charity is the synonym for love, you don't know what you're talking about. Imagine the young man at that moment in his life when he is going to say the big, important fact and question, kneeling to the young lady and saying, darling, I wish you'd marry me. For you, I feel great charity. He'd tell him to chase his charity down the street to somebody else. It's no equivalent, no equivalent, nor is the word philanthropy, which always makes me think of a stern man seated behind a desk and saying, before I give you that $25 from our great fund, have you collected $3,875,000? And when you say you haven't, you don't get the 25 bucks. That's philanthropy. And you never use the word philanthropy except in these modern, frigid connections. The impersonality of modern charity. Cold as charity. But love, oh, love is a wonderful word. So the first thing that you have to recognize about love is the fact that love is not a matter of emotion nor necessarily of passion. Don't for a moment suggest that Father Lord says that emotion and passion may not have a great deal to do with love. I think I feel very sorry for any woman who is married to one of these great, strong, silent hunks of mail, who never tells her he loves her anymore, never holds her hand. There is a sort of instinct in us. We are bodies and souls, and to express what's in our soul, we need our body. Somehow or other, we've got to have that. So a young couple walk along the street together, and all of a sudden, they begin to take hands. Now, that's the silliest performance in the world. You know, a couple of crooked claws gripping down here. That, as a matter of fact, it says things to her that nothing in the world could say. Or they get to the motion picture theater, and they sit together, and suddenly their shoulders touch. And the whole place is technicolor. No matter what the film is. Love is one of those things that you will best express in your deeds, as St. Ignatius says, or you best express at a time when you're feeling no emotion at all. There's the mother
who dearly and devotedly loves that little youngster of hers. Oh, the first moment that they laid that baby in her hand, she with her antiseptic veil across her face, wishing she could kiss it. And the moment when she sees the little child go off to its first communion. Wonderful. When does she love it most? At 3 o'clock in the morning. When does a man love his country best? In the trenches. When he gives up a $25,000 a year job to go into the Army or Navy or one of the services. Any thrills? Any emotions? Not the least. Now this strange thing called love, which we're going to discuss more in detail this evening, is a very wonderful thing and a thing that we ought in some way to understand. I can remember my dear old Irish professor of philosophy, God bless him, Paul Gleason, who used to look out at us from eyebrows that were like Osage hedges that had never been cut. And he'd say, I feel sorry for you young men if the day ever comes when you have to live in a world that's ruled by atheists. No man can be an atheist for any length of time and remain a decent guy. Something's going to crack, and maybe it's going to be you. I remember I used to sit in the back of the class and say, oh, yeah. Well, we've seen atheism on a big scale now. We saw it practiced by Hitler. We saw it practiced by Stalin. We see it practiced in the communist countries, and now we know. Nobody has to prove it to us anymore. We know what atheism does in terms of concentration camps and the complete destruction of the rights of people. We know that. What did the Lord really tell us to do? One of the most exciting things and the strangest things is that though in the church, we priests, and I strike my own breast, are constantly talking about the Ten Commandments, the Lord never did. Just never did. Only once does he mention them explicitly, and then he doesn't call them the Ten. That was the time when the rich young man came to see him, and he said, Lord, what shall I do to be saved? Well, the Lord heard that a dozen times a day from people who were fakers. They wanted to pretend that they were interested. So he just, in a casual kind of way, said, oh, keep the commandments. Well, the young fellow said, I've been doing that all my life. You have, said the Lord? Oh. And he looked at him, and he loved him. And he said, well, if you really, really want to be perfect, you want to do a good job. Go sell what you have and give it to the poor. Love your neighbor. And come and follow me. Love God. Once the Ten Commandments were shoved right into his face, the Pharisee came up to him and he said, now, which is the greatest commandment? That's a trick question, because you're often asked that kind of question in the hope that you'll pick out one. And then the person who asks you can say, see, he despises the other nine. So he knew it was a trick. They expected him to say, thou shalt not kill, thou shalt not commit adultery. That was a favorite even in those days. Thou shalt not lie, or so on. But he didn't. He said, you want to know the great commandment? Thou shalt love the Lord thy God with thy whole mind, heart, soul, and strength. And there's another commandment, by the way. It's very much like that. Thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself. Now, if you keep those two commandments, everything is going to be wonderful. That's the law. That's the prophets. That's the solution. Go out and do it. Well, I don't know what happened in the course of time. A lot of people got working on that. Now the Ten Commandments, the Ten Commandments, the Ten Commandments. And who says, love God and love your neighbor? Who says it? It's a little discouraging. In view of the fact that nothing in history has worked the way love has worked, whether love is practiced by a Catholic, a saint, or a man with no faith at all. You know, there's a few solutions for the problems of the world that we all rely on. One of the solutions for the problem of the world is money. Let's spend enough money and everybody will love us. That's our country down there, my country. We've spent more money in the last 20 years trying to make people love us. France doesn't love us. Italy doesn't love us. Czechoslovakia doesn't love us. Tito doesn't love us. trying to buy Tito now. Oh, do love us, Tito. Do love us. How much more money would you like? Another $2 billion? Well, here you are. You know the only people in the world that love the United States? The Canadians. And the reason it is because we never gave you a doggone cent. Nobody loves people who try to win their affection with money. But, of course, the other solution to the problem of the world were force. Force. Let's go out and get the biggest navy, the biggest army, the biggest air force, the biggest A-bomb, the biggest H-bomb. We got the biggest force in the world. You know, that even goes down into personal dealings. I can recall when the caveman was first invented. It's always amused me. We know so much more about the caveman and what he did and ate than we know about the guy that lives next door to us. So much more. But it became the idea that women loved a caveman. And nothing made them adore a man so much as to have him come home with a baseball bat, slug him over the head, pull him into the kitchen, and say, get to work, woman. So we've got the idea that we can win the world by force. Force them into it. Beat you till you submit. Or the old Irish expression, I don't bait you because I hate you, but just to show me your authority. Well, if that was the solution, if force was the solution, and if being bigger and stronger and knocking people around was it, shouldn't the Irish adore the English? Shouldn't the Negro of the South love us white folks? I wonder. The Lord said, very simply, thou shalt love the Lord thy God with thy whole mind, heart, soul, and strength, and thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself. That was all. That was his answer, and that was his complete and total answer. Thou shalt love, thou shalt love, thou shalt love. But we say to ourselves, that's totally impractical. Let's use our heads. That isn't the way it works. Was the Lord so impractical? I don't think so. Show me any other man in the whole of history that without any resources, an army, a navy, show me any man who without a crowd of clever followers established an organization that has been constantly beaten and beaten and beaten for 300 years and still keeps on. Every once in a while, the Lord says something that is simply and totally absurd. Nonsense. For instance, he says, blessed are the meek, for they shall possess the land. That's stupid. You know darn well who possesses the land. The rich, the wealthy, the big corporations, the nations with the big armies, the big colonizing fleets. They take over the world. Maybe. But never do I pass one of these magnificent palatial mansions being put up by some multi-millionaire, surrounded by great stretches of lawn with garages and stables in the rear, that I don't say to myself, I wonder which order of sisters will get that. I can just see old Mother Pancratius walking into the rathskeller in the basement and saying, this will be perfect for the novices. Did you ever know anybody that was meeker than nuns? Did you ever know anybody that took over the land the way they do? It is wonderful. Simply and completely wonderful. The Lord's a very, very practical man, and actually, as long as Christianity acted on that, we took over the world. The early days of Christianity, the apostles moved across the world as had never been done by man in the history of human conquest. And yet, it is simply impossible for us to imagine St. Peter leading an army, or St. Paul on the quarterdeck of a battleship. Thou shalt love the Lord thy God with thy whole mind, heart, soul, and strength, and thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself. Well, let's take a look at that. Lots of people nowadays in those words charity and philanthropy are trying to obey the second commandment. That's the hard one. The easy one is the first. And almost nobody tries to practice the first. God is the Father on the top of the hill, watching for the returning prodigal. His arms outstretched to hold that boy to his heart, even though he's stained with mud and covered with the stink of a pigsty. That's God. God's that wonderful Savior who walked the highways looking for you because he loved you. And when he couldn't find you, he climbed up on a cross, hoping that he could see you from that elevation. And then he died rather than let you die. That's your God. And God is a comforter. That's what Christ promised, a comforter. Almost like a human being who spends his time holding your hand and telling you everything is fine. A comforter, as we use the expression for that soft, downy, quilty thing that we tuck in around us on a cold night. God is our comforter. That's your God. It's awfully hard to love your fellow men, but it's easy to love God if you stop to think about him. Human beings aren't particularly lovable. But God, oh God, is impossible not to love if you'll give yourself a chance. Love the Lord your God. Because if you do, then a very strange thing happens. Human beings who otherwise are not lovable become lovable. Because you say to yourself, isn't this wonderful? God loved them. If God loved them, who am I not to? Men and women and all colors and all races and all creeds and all types. He made them all. And he made them all because he loved them. To try to love your fellow men without loving God, I don't think it can be done. Human beings are not lovable. And yet the Lord says, thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself. So as soon as you say that or begin to talk about it, all normal people say, now, Father, have a heart. The ship goes down. There's one life preserver. I've got it. Over there's that guy. I can't stand him. So I got to throw the life preserver over to him, do I? That is what the Lord said. The Lord said something very different. The Lord said, thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself. And actually, there were three commandments. Thou shalt love the Lord thy God, thou shalt love thy neighbor, and thou shalt love thyself. Did you ever stop to think about that? God told you to love yourself. Now, ladies and gentlemen, I want to assure you with great emphasis that that is one commandment that you have obeyed. You have obeyed that beautifully. And without even thinking about it. Health, food, house, love, truth, recreation, God. You loved yourself by seeing to it that you got those things. Which one of them, in all decency, would you deny to one of your fellow men? Well, like a good Christian, you say instinctively, well, I don't think I'd deny any of them to them. No. But would you really make a serious effort to see that they got those things? Sufficient food, health, decent place to live in, chance to get married, truth, recreation, God. Would you try that? And right there at that point, we all have to stop. Because the history of mankind has been the terrible story of one man trying to take away from other men, or one nation taking away from other nations, or one people taking another away from the other people, some or all of those things. Fighting the communists is the last way in the world to beat them. You just fight people, and that's when they get strong. You love them, and you take away the reasons for their hating you. Every communist across the world is a man who was badly fed, badly clothed, badly housed, denied the truth, no chance for marriage, recreation,
I've always had the greatest possible sympathy for the Paris mob. What they did was horrible. The reason that they did it was because men and women in high places had failed to love us. And if there is a communism in the world today, let's realize it is the fault of us who did not give those people the love and the things that flow from love. Food, clothing, housing, chance for marriage, recreation, and the things that go with truth and with God. The answer to the problems of the world are very simple. It's love, that's it. An unloved child is a queer child. An unloved child is the child who grows up to be a broken adult or a criminal. An unloved nation is a nation by that very fact that is doomed to become a problem nation across the world. A class of people who are downtrodden eventually will rise up and take over as they did in Haiti and bathe the land in the blood of the people whom they have been taught to hate. We don't have to begin with a national problem. We begin right down inside ourselves. We have no right to deny to any man those things that we want for ourselves. We have no right to decide a class or a race or a nation or a color or a creed. By the very fact that they belong to it, have no right to these things. And we have an obligation, we Catholics, of supporting everything that sees to it that the God-given decencies of life be given to as many people as possible. If we do that, we shall have no worries about the future.